You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie in the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Sorry for not being here last week. If you're on our social media, you already know the reason why. If you're not, let me tell you. My husband was home for 10 days vacation, and honestly, we had such a great time and did so much fun stuff that I asked Annie if it would be okay on short notice to take a week off. And that's what we did. And we're back now. And we have a really interesting cold case for you this week.
I'm
right?
So excited. I was also so excited when you said, hey, do you mind? Because I have the most horrific like head cold that I came back with. And I was like, nope, this timing is great for me. I'm going back to bed. So not long ago, we spoke with a friend of the show, Hellion Amanda Graves, about the tragic unsolved murder of her older sister, Kelly. We spoke to her as part of our Tell Me Everything segment, which is on Patreon. We're going to insert a couple of excerpts from that interview in this episode, and you can listen to our whole conversation with Amanda on Patreon. Amanda is a tireless advocate for her late sister, and you can tell how important this case is to her from talking to her. And it was a really eye-opening conversation about what life is like when something like this happens in your family, you know? So in addition to our coverage today, there's an episode of Paula Zahn about this case. It is season 24, episode 14, which is currently available on Max. There's also an episode of the podcast The Deck, which is one of Ashley Flower's podcasts, and they cover Kelly's case as well.
The deck refers to the cold case playing cards used in many prisons where the usual artwork has been replaced with unsolved murder information in the hopes that someone who knows something will see it and can provide a tip to close a case, which has happened before. And we've discussed them before, and I personally think it's such a great and simple idea.
It really is. So smart. So both of those programs are great, and they have lots of interviews with those directly involved. And I wanted to cover some of the things I still had a few questions about after watching those programs and reading contemporary newspaper articles from the time. In particular, there were several other cases mentioned that I would read a lot that would say, you know, they thought it might be part of a serial killer. And I was like, well, I need more information on that. So I found it out, and now I have it for you. The other primary sources in this episode are, as usual, a lot of archived newspaper articles and also some court records. Also, a content warning, the victims in this episode are children and young adults, and the issues and the details are very hard to hear. This is not an appropriate episode for your children to listen to. We're going to be talking about torture, sexual assault. This is a tough one. Today, we're starting in Sunol, which is a small, unincorporated town with a very quaint, historic vibe in Alameda County, California. It's 17 miles or 27 kilometers north of San Jose and 32 miles or 51 kilometers southeast of San Francisco. The most interesting claim to fame I found when I was looking, and to be honest, there were quite a few to choose from, is that in 1981, two mayoral candidates were defeated by Mayor Bosco, a lab Rottweiler mix, who served as the mayor of the town for 13 years until 1994, when he passed away at the ripe old age of 15. That's a good old age for a dog that size. And remind me, because I'm going to tell you more about Bosco, Mayor Bosco, his statue, and the really bizarre replica of him at the end of the episode, because this is a tough one, so we're going to need it.
I need to hear everything about that, because I would vote for a dog.
Who wouldn't?
Over most people.
Of course you would.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're going to talk about the really terrible stuff. It was around 5:30 at night on Friday, December 2nd, 1983. when a man arrived home on Kilcare Road, which was a quiet, remote, dead-end street that ran alongside the woods, and he ran for the phone to call for help. He said that he had seen the body of a woman on the side of the road with a bag over her head, and they immediately sent information to dispatch, who ordered emergency vehicles to the scene. Less than 10 minutes after the call was placed, the first emergency responder to arrive was a fireman named Ken. He's in the Palazon episode, and he talks about how difficult it was to report to that scene. When he arrived, there on the side of the road, laying in a sort of twisted position with her jeans pulled down and only one of her very trendy black and white checkerboard Vans on, was the body of a girl. The victim was bleeding and therefore still alive. So his immediate priority shifted to a rescue. And in order to perform CPR, he's going to have to remove that brown garbage bag secured around her neck with a coax cable. It was the sort of cable from the 80s where you would use it to connect your TV to the cable box or to connect your TV to your VCR back in the day. I think most of us are familiar with those. For the young people, we used to have these cables that we'd have to screw into the back. So one of those cables is wrapped tightly around her neck, securing this bag over her head. So he cuts that away, and then he finds another plastic bag. This one is marked Korea Duty Free. He then removed a red polka dot necktie that was wrapped tightly around her neck like a noose in order to begin CPR. The ambulance, which had been dispatched when the call came in, arrived, and the girl was rushed to the nearest hospital in Fremont. Sadly, she was pronounced dead only moments after arriving. Just like less than 10 minutes, I think. The cause of death was ligature strangulation, probably because of the red silk tie that was so tightly around her neck. But she also had very severe head trauma, with several fatal blows to her head that caused fractured skull. So she had, there were a number of blows to the back of her head, which each on their own could have killed her. She had been really brutally, savagely beaten and also sexually assaulted. They had no idea who she was, but they felt sure she had been killed someplace other than the side of the road and then dumped there. And they thought it was likely to be two suspects, one driving while the other pushed her from the moving car.
I'm going back and forth here in my head, but I think it could have also been done by one person.
I totally agree. We don't know it was a moving car. It's a theory because she was found in sort of a twisted position, I guess, that would made them think that she rolled out of a moving car. I don't think there was much of a, my understanding is there's no, I think this is a really like narrow, twisty, middle of nowhere road without.
Yeah.
But I also think that one person could stop, reach over, open the door and just push her out and then start driving and the door would shut. I don't think that's hard to imagine. She's also missing one of those sneakers. It was never recovered. So let's talk about the rest of the evidence, which was contaminated in the first aid response. There was a brown trash bag over her head that was fingerprinted. They ruled out first responder prints and were left with six unidentified fingerprints. So that's pretty good. They also had that Welcome to Korea duty-free bag. Also, in the bag over her head, there was this very bloody, very 80s striped gray sweater that had been made in Korea. The investigators reached out to the feds and also to the military, and they were able to determine that the duty-free bag could have come from any one of four airports located in South Korea. So, in South Korea, there were four airports at the time that were using this particular duty-free bag. At that time, I think they thought, rather than thinking that the killer might be Korean himself, I think they were looking for people who had traveled there recently, and that's why they were maybe thinking military. I'm not sure why they would immediately jump to somebody who had visited rather than somebody from there. Maybe because the area was so remote. I don't know. But there were problems with this investigation. Obviously, there are always issues in every investigation because we're humans and nobody is perfect. But one thing they got right was they got a very good DNA sample from the killer.
And I find that so amazing because, I mean,
yeah,
It's the early 80s.
Yeah. I think
there
that's huge.
There was no use for that back then in regards of DNA testing, but still they secured the sample.
Exactly. Exactly. They did a lot of things right. So they didn't know who she was. There was no identification on her. And so the day after she was found, they sent some information out to the local media asking for help, identifying a young woman between the ages of 18 and 22 with short reddish brown hair. And they gave a description of what she was wearing, from her really trendy red and white blouse down to those checkered black and white Van shoes. She was cool. She was a cool dresser. Meanwhile, Amanda's mother, Teresa, is at home, and this news report comes on, and she knows it's her daughter, 14-year-old Kelly Poppleton, who she had just reported missing the day before, the same day that she was found, she was reported missing. And worse, Teresa was a dispatcher who had ordered the ambulance to her own daughter's crime scene without ever realizing it. Amanda talked to us a little bit about this when we had our conversation with her.
It's so the guy that found her called 911. The 911 calls the ambulance company to send the ambulance out or whatever. My mom was the ambulance dispatcher that sent the ambulance out.
Not knowing it was your sister. Yeah. Not knowing it was her daughter.
Oh my God.
It was just an unidentified adult female. And so there's some things that people think that she was the 911 operator. No, she was the ambulance dispatcher.
So she didn't realize until later when they were explaining about on the news, she'd seen the report, right?
Yeah.
Because they had gone to the police initially, right? Yeah. When she didn't come home from school.
Yeah. Well, I found that out later. They never told me that they had reported her missing. Growing up, I had to piece things together.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Teresa and her husband Tracy, who was a very loving stepdad, went right to the police station, and Tracy agreed to go to the coroner's office to confirm their absolute worst fears and save his wife Teresa that trauma. And he confirmed that the girl was their daughter, Kelly Jean Poppleton, and she was only 14, so she was in the 8th grade and attending the local middle school. She had not returned home from school the day before, the Friday, and the investigation revealed that her parents had dropped Kelly off at school at 8:45 on Friday morning, and she had been in school all day. At the end of the school day, rather than going to her parents' work after school, Kelly had gone to her old neighborhood by taking a couple of buses. She had told friends where she was going, and her parents weren't surprised. The family had recently moved to a new neighborhood, and she was going to visit her old friends. She was seen on both buses, and she was seen outside a liquor store using a payphone. And that's when she vanished.
Yeah, the liquor store was like a local teen hangout. A lot of liquor stores in Massachusetts also had a really, really decent penny candy selection back in the 80s. So that's not, if you're not from the States, that might sound a bit iffy. I think I'm also defensive of her because there was a sort of bad girl narrative around Kelly that she never deserved. You know what I mean?
She took care of me a lot. Kelly took care of us and she loved to babysit. Mm. Like most kids. You know, her age, they don't want to babysit their younger sibling. Kelly loved to watch us. Even some of her friends at that time, they've messaged me and they're like, Kelly absolutely loved to watch you. She loved being a big sister. And like Halloween, she called a friend up and was like, hey, we're going out for Halloween. Come on. And her friend thought they were going to go party. Well, it was the take me trick-or-treating.
Oh, that's so cute.
And she was like, even though she was expecting, you know, a party, going out trick-or-treating with me and Kelly, she had a blast. You know, she wasn't expecting Kelly to do that, but she was like, wow, this girl really loves her little sister. So it was fun times. And like, she was a little rebellious. She was told not to play with the shrinky dinks. Her and my cousin blew the door off the oven.
No.
Yeah, well, my mom was napping. And so, yeah, so, you know, they, spunky little kid.
Yeah. typical 80s, 70s, 80s kids.
Yeah. It was a different time, so the rules were a little different back then.
Absolutely. Everything was different. Tell us more about Kelly. So she loved D&D.
Yeah.
She liked to smoke a little weed. She definitely sounds like my kind of people.
Horror movies. The Poltergeist.
Oh, she was into Poltergeist.
Yes. She scared my mom with that movie. She turned the TV on the Snowy Channel. Are those pink phones like Carol Ann? Set me in front. Yep. And said, Mama, come in here. My mom comes in. And she took Kelly had taught me to say, there he is. My roof and freaked out because my mom doesn't do horror. So
she's one of us, totally.
She would have been totally one of us. I think to this day, growing up, she influenced me. And that's why I am the way I am, because she influenced me as a kid and she's still doing it.
Do you actively vividly remember things about her, or is it more that you remember the things that you later heard about her and the stories and the photos? Because you were very young when all this happened.
Yeah, I was three. Yeah. I have one memory of me. I was actually climbing over the crib to mess with our little brother, and she yelled at me and spiked my butt. There's a video somewhere that I saw when I was younger, and we're playing outside. A ball rolls into the street. I go after it, and she grabs me by my hair to pull me out of the street as a car comes. So she saved
me. Save you. Yeah.
The cool, awesome, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High was her movie.
Mm-hmm.
Macaulay was her man. When we were watching Stranger Things, the character Eddie.
Yes.
I was like, that was Kelly. It was her. That was her standing on the table. You know, she was very passionate and spunky. She fought back.
Yeah.
I fully believe. She went down fighting.
So, back to that Friday, her parents, after looking everywhere they could think to look and talking to all of Kelly's friends, they went down to the police station at around 11:30 p.m. and reported their 14-year-old daughter missing. Now, her body had been found around 5:30 that same afternoon, but just nobody put the pieces together. Back to the evidence, there was a cream-colored Plymouth Duster seen parked on the street where she was seen walking in her old neighborhood, and then over on Kilcare Road, around the same time Kelly's body was found, there were two witnesses who described a light-colored Dodge Colt or a Datsun B210. And there was also a black or very dark colored Pontiac Trans Am seen in the area. And unfortunately, neither witness could describe the drivers, although I'm not sure how accurate any of that would have been. But those cars have always been sort of ones to think about for that time period in that place. Police quickly ruled out Kelly's boyfriend at the time. And once that was done, they really weren't sure where to look next. And keep in mind, of course, that I've told you all the evidence, but some of this they were still waiting for. Not everything is going to come back right away. This is all kind of happening over days and weeks and months. So a week after she was murdered, police receive a tip. A woman named Pam called the police to say she was certain that her 13-year-old daughter, Trina, was involved in Kelly's murder. Sure enough, Trina confesses. She tells investigators that she, Kelly, and another 13-year-old girl were selling drugs for a man who lived in the same apartment area as Trina did. Like, I'm not exactly sure if it was the same building or the same complex, but they didn't live together, but he lived, like, in her
neighborhood.
Yeah, in her immediate neighborhood, if that makes sense. And all of this was pretty close to where Kelly used to live. So Trina tells investigators that this man, who is 27, and another 17-year-old kid are both drug dealers, and they were angry because they had recently gotten into some legal trouble, and they believed that Kelly was the one who had given their names to the police. She told the police that she and the other girl were responsible for getting Kelly to them, and that they had come up with a plan to sort of lure her to visit and then get her into this car. Once they grab her, she tells police that the two men beat Kelly to death and then dumped her on the side of the road. The story she tells is a lot more complicated than what I've just shared. There's a lot of details. She has info on how Kelly was killed. It matches with all the details that the investigators have. They arrest Trina and they arrest the other girl and the two men that she talked about, the three teenagers and the one adult. While they're in custody, more problems arrive because their alibis are checking out. And they start to find more and more problems in Trina's story. They're on an all-out fact-finding mission, and the facts are just not supporting what Trina said about the people that they have arrested. Apart from the one older guy who I think was on a parole violation, the episode of The Deck covers Trina's involvement at length, and there's a lot to get into. I'm not going to get into it because it's all a lie. Spoiler alert. Trina had nothing to do with anything that happened to Kelly. They didn't know each other. I don't know that they'd ever met each other. All of the information that Trina was giving to investigators about Kelly's murder is information that she had read herself in the news or seen on TV. And what makes this whole situation doubly awful is that Trina's mother essentially forced her to confess. She refused to believe that her daughter was not involved. In the Paula Zahn episode, one of the defense attorneys explains that, you know, her job was trying to figuring out a defense for Trina, and it wasn't hard to do because all of the people she said were involved had really rock-solid alibis, so there was no way. And she explains how relieved Trina felt when everything came out into the open. She explained that things were so bad that when the three other people were released, Trina was held in protective custody for a while because police didn't feel that she would be safe at home. That's how problematic her home life was. She felt like she would rather make this confession and go to jail than be at home. Eventually, she was released into the foster care system, and she is another victim of this story. Her mother's behavior really did a lot of damage, damaged a lot of people, damaged the investigation, really irreparably. I think that there's a lot of very justified anger and fury toward Pam. And this left the case feeling kind of deflated. I think investigators, you have to remember, this was a really tiny, unincorporated town, and they just weren't familiar with false confessions. It just never occurred to anybody that a 13-year-old girl would ever make up something like this. In May 1983, the investigators reach out to the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit for a profile. The profile suggests more than one offender. They say that this person is in their late teens, early 20s. He is not married and regularly uses drugs and alcohol. So that's really going to narrow things down a lot, huh? Like high school and college students who aren't married and regularly use like drugs and alcohol. Yeah. Not in the early 80s. So the town was doing sort of the best they could, though, and the problem now was that more girls were dying.
So on 5th of April 1984, 14-year-old Tina Fales decided to walk home from high school rather than take the bus. Tina was pretty and funny with short reddish hair and freckles, and there was a clique of mean girls who'd been bullying her, and she decided to take the creepy way home through the culvert that provided a safe shortcut beneath the interstate. She should have been safe, but she wasn't. Tina was stabbed 44 times with a kitchen knife and was left to bleed to death near a creek bed, her body found by other students walking home. Unlike the others, she was not sexually assaulted, but the frenzied stabbing had the sign of rage. Kind of in the same way that Kelly's beating had these signs of rage. Her case too soon went cold, devastating to her loved ones and also traumatizing her younger brother, Drew, who was only 8 when his sister was murdered so horrifically. And he is quoted in several articles talking about how he couldn't sleep unless his mom was outside the door because that's the only way he felt safe enough to sleep. And it's pretty similar to what Amanda told us, how she, growing up, had this feeling of her sister's murderer would come for her, right?
Yes, that's the first thing I thought of as well.
Yeah.
The third murder happened just 15 days later. So you can see why they would think that these were maybe connected. This is a lot of, feels like a lot of young women dying to me. So on April 20th, 1984, 18-year-old Julie Ann Connell disappeared after she went to Kennedy Park in Hayward, California to read her book. Like, I think that one really, they all hit me hard, but like going to the park to read her book. How is that not safe? She was smart and sweet, and she had this gorgeous mane of hair and was looking forward to her graduation. There was an upcoming class graduation trip to Disneyland that she had saved for. She had her cap and gown. Her whole future was ready for her. Her body was found 5 days later in an animal pasture near Castro Valley. She had been tied up with green twine, sexually assaulted, and both her throat and right wrist had been slashed multiple times. I wondered whether the wrist might have been a defensive move, but it's hard to know. She fought really hard, though. She didn't go easily. The next murder was 18-year-old Lisa Ann Monzo. She was a really hardworking, bright young woman. Again, just the whole world open in front of her. The following is an excerpt from a UPI article dated December 1st, 1984, entitled, "Police Have No Suspects in Teenage Slay Case." And this article reads in part, quote, "The partially concealed body of Lisa Ann Monzo, 18, was found Thursday near a densely populated neighborhood. The coroner confirmed Friday that she had been strangled. Police later said she also appeared to have been sexually molested. Sheriff's deputies said Monzo disappeared Tuesday afternoon while walking from her doctor's office in San Leandro to a restaurant where she worked 3 days a week. Her body was found by an officer a short distance from the restaurant, near a railroad underpass. Her body was partially hidden by leaves, pine needles, and other debris. A spokesman for the sheriff's office said, 'We have several leads, but no suspects.' He also said that the Monzo case was being considered apart from three other slayings of teenage girls in Alameda County during this past year. The spokesman said that eventually investigators will compare the latest case with the evidence gathered in the unsolved slayings of the other three girls. A year ago, the body of Kelly Jean Poppleton, a 14-year-old Fremont Junior High School student, was found near Sunol. She had been stabbed. 8 months ago, Julie Connell, an 18-year-old student from San Lorenzo, disappeared from Hayward Park. Her body was found 6 days later in a field. She had been stabbed and her throat cut. And last April, Tina Mary Fales, a 14-year-old from Pleasanton, was stabbed to death on a popular shortcut used by students under a freeway near the Alameda County Fairgrounds." End quote.
Yeah, all of these murders took place close enough when thinking of the geographical locations, but also close enough in time that it makes absolute sense that they'd have thought they were connected. I would have thought the same.
Mm-hmm.
And all victims were like young teenage girls, young adults.
Yes.
All victims had been raped.
Except for Tina. Tina's the only one that I would say was
Tina,
different.
Sorry, I forgot about that. Yeah, yeah.
Because I would
almost
say that
almost all victims had been raped, yeah.
Yeah, and Kelly looked more like 18.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, even the investigators thought they were looking at a young adult woman.
Exactly, exactly.
And the good thing is all of the crime scenes had DNA they found, so they collected DNA from all crime scenes.
That's right. And sure enough, one by one, they solved those cases because of that DNA. The first one to be solved was that of Lisa Monzo. Michael Patrick Ide was already in prison for life without parole for the February 1986 robbery, sexual assault, and strangulation of 68-year-old Ellen Parker in Washington State. It seems like while he was in prison, he told inmates about his other crimes, which included the sexual abuse of his own family members and other children. He had a long list of sexual assaults to talk about. Sidebar, this also, Johanna, can I tell you, learning this was kind of a new worry. Can you imagine if you were in prison, especially wrongly in prison, and then someone just starts telling you everything awful that they've done while you're in prison with them?
I don't know. I always have the impression that's such a common occurrence, though. Like, it's not unusual that this happens, because what do they have to do the whole day except for talking? And most people who do these kind of things like to brag about them.
Of course.
Because they think the other person is going to be like, wow, you're so cool.
I know. I think this is the first time I ever thought of, like, the mental well-being of the person hearing this information.
Yeah. Well, at least they can use the knowledge to their advantage.
Well, true.
Like, get a good deal.
I hope so. So I'd also confessed to the rape and murder of Lisa, and authorities were given that information. Sure enough, the DNA matched, and at the end of 1996, Michael Patrick Ide was convicted in Lisa's case and sentenced to death. He died in prison of natural causes in 2005. The next case closed was that of Julie Connell, and unfortunately, it was solved because another really horrifying murder took place. In May 1996, 8-year-old Michael Lyons was kidnapped on his way home from school in Yuba City, California. Michael was tortured for 10 hours in the most horrific ways before he died. DNA from his crime was a match to the DNA discovered at Julie's, and they were able to solve his murder. Robert Boyd Rhodes would be sentenced to the death penalty twice for these crimes. I have an excerpt from a letter that Michael's mother wrote to support a petition to uphold the death penalty in California. This is essentially a victim impact statement without getting into the full victim impact statement from that trial. And I just felt like if she had to survive this whole situation and took the time to write this, the least I could do is share some of her words, which will also detail the other crimes Rhodes committed. And I'm going to warn you again that this is a particularly tough letter to hear. She writes, quote, "My name is Sandra. I'm the mother of Michael Lyons. Michael was brutally murdered in May 1996 in Yuba City, California. He was only 8 years old when he was kidnapped while he was walking home from school. Michael never made it home that day, for there was a sexual predator stalking him. This monster took Michael, tortured him for 10 hours, inflicting 70 to 80 non-lethal stab wounds to my little boy. Yet he was not finished. He continued to rape Michael the entire time. He ultimately took his life the following morning. The monster who took Michael is no stranger to the criminal justice system. Robert Rhodes is a serial killer and a rapist who preys on the innocent. In April 1984, he kidnapped, raped, and murdered Julie Connell in Alameda County while she studied at Pleasanton Park. 4 days later, he robbed another woman in San Lorenzo, California. 1 year later, in April 1985, Rhodes kidnapped, robbed, sexually assaulted, and tortured a woman at knife point in Yuba County. Rhodes told the victim that he was taking her to the river bottoms in Marysville to kill her. This victim jumped from a moving car to save her own life. In 1993, Rhodes sexually assaulted a 4-year-old girl in Amador County. A few years later, he murdered my little boy. Rhodes rightfully received the death penalty in both Michael and Julie's cases. Our communities could see the pure evil monster that our children came across on those fateful days. Members of our communities delivered the only punishment deserving of his crimes, the death penalty. Rhodes is the poster child for the death penalty. He is the reason we all need to stand up and be heard, because these monsters will never stop. Rhodes is a master manipulator, meticulous in each crime he does, as he says, quote, the good ones never get caught. He is a monster who targets our children. He has no remorse for the crimes he has committed. He is pure evil. Rhodes was hiding amongst us year after year, destroying our communities and our lives by taking the things we cherish most, our loved ones. Rhodes may have thought he silenced Michael, but Michael will never be silenced. I will be Michael's voice, and I will continue to fight for Michael's rights, for the victims' rights. I may have been a victim, but now I am a survivor. Thank you for your time. End quote. I really think that regardless of your own feelings about the death penalty aside, we can all understand exactly how, no, we can't understand exactly how she feels. We can all understand why she feels this way. And she certainly
makes, where she's coming from. Yeah.
Yeah. A compelling argument.
Yeah.
And Robert Boyd Rhodes is still in prison, but he is not likely to be executed anymore in California.
He's also a different person from Robert Benjamin Rhodes, aka the truck stop killer. And I also think this is why English-speaking countries like to use all three names,
yeah.
Like also the middle name. Yeah,
exactly. What are the odds? It's R-H-O-A-D-E-S. It's not even the most easy spelling of Rhodes.
Robert B. Rhodes would be too little information already to know which one we're talking
about.
Right,
because there's two Robert B. Rhodeses.
Yeah.
Robert Boyd and Robert Benjamin. I don't think they're related. They might be. I didn't look into that. Someone else might know. I don't want to know.
So Tina's case was solved in 2011 when Quantico informed police that they had a match on the DNA from a drop of blood on her purse near her crime scene, and that matched a former classmate of hers, Stephen J. Carlson, who himself was just 16 at the time of the murder. He would later admit to seeing her outside his window, taking a knife and stabbing her, claiming he was drunk at the time and had been struggling with football players beating him up and throwing him in a dumpster. He was also in trouble with his parents for throwing a party, and he claimed that he simply snapped.
Yeah.
Which...
it was just too much. And he was also drunk at the time. He had some problems. I mean, the idea that a girl who was being bullied didn't want to take the bus, so she walked the long way home to avoid mean kids, was then murdered by another bullied kid who had been thrown in a dumpster one time too many. That irony is not lost on me. I think a lot of people who didn't live in the 80s but have seen movies that romanticize it a lot. My best friend and I were just sort of talking about this with her kids because they think the 80s was such a really fun and cool time. And it was. There's a lot to miss, but it was a savage time to be in school. It was not an easy, you had to survive the 80s. And don't get me wrong, I'm not making any excuses for Carlson.
I mean, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
It's not like he did this one thing and then he was the perfect angel. And
yeah, no. He's the worst.
He has a record. He has, he's a registered sex offender. So he's absolutely bad news. In 2014, he was tried as an adult for Tina's murder, even though he was 16 when it happened. And he was found guilty of first degree murder and sentenced to 26 years to life. How many times did he stab her? 40 times?
44.
44. In 2017, an appeal panel found that the premeditation and deliberate intent needed for a first-degree conviction hadn't been proven, and the charge was reduced to second degree. His most recent parole hearing was last month, actually, so February 2024, and it was actually postponed.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was just postponed. I'm sure Tina's family and other loved ones won't be alone attending these hearings and doing their best to make sure that he stays exactly where he is, because that's where he belongs. So Lisa, Tina, and Julie's cases were all solved with DNA, but not Kelly's. In 2004, the Alameda County Sheriff's Office gathered up all the evidence from Kilcare Road that had been in storage for the past 20 years. Everything was well preserved. They had all of the items, the two bags, the tie, the cable, the bloody sweater, as well as the swabs. And they were able to get a full genetic profile of an unknown man and upload it into CODIS. But nothing was a match. Still, detectives didn't give up. They had their genetic profile and they traveled the country, even into Canada, following every possible lead. But nothing came of it. No matches anywhere. Once Tina's murder was solved in 2011, finally proving once and for all that these four cases were not the work of one serial killer. I mean, there were other serial killers at work, but in a really horrible twist of fate, each one of these young women was killed by someone else. So once they really realized there was no connection, the detectives working on Kelly's case got in touch with Parabon Nanolabs. Parabon creates a more detailed picture using genetic DNA. And I think genetic genealogy, as far as I can tell, is most popular here in the US because we're just such a huge genetic melting pot. Like, my family in England don't have any interest spending £100 to find out if they're English, right? I'm assuming it's the same for you. Have you bothered?
Yeah, no, I really don't think it's super popular in Europe. Like, we mostly know our genetic genealogy, even though, for example, here, former Habsburg Empire countries, like, they were a melting pot as well, but you know most of it. There is no big surprise. Like, I know that the biggest part of my family were a German ethnicity in Hungary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think I know just one person in my group of acquaintances, not even a close friend, who did it. Like, that's the only person I know over here who tried it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, even he, not a big surprise there.
Yeah. Paul and I, both being adopted, kind of had a lot of fun figuring out what it was. So we both did this, and Paul is not white. My husband is not white. He has the most beautiful brown skin. We all had theories about what his background could be, because the combinations are honestly endless. Mm-hmm. Every time you met someone, whatever they were, they thought that's what he was. Do you know what I mean? So, like, people who are a lot of Italian were like, oh, you could be Sicilian. And other people were like, no, you look at Spanish. You look Mexican. You whatever it was. Everybody had their own theories. And he was born in Oklahoma, which is where his parents were stationed when he was born and adopted. So it turned out Paul was mostly Native American, and I am 99% European. Mostly France and the UK, but it changes slightly all the time. In fact, my most recent one, I now have some German ancestry. So it went from just France and, like, specifically the Normandy region of France. But now there's, like, a part of Germany that's also highlighted, which is kind of interesting. We did this over a decade ago, and we constantly get more and more specific updates. I also did a 23andMe as part of a study for people with Crohn's disease. And it gives you all these really interesting little traits that they can suss out with my DNA. So, for example, things about my eye color and whether or not I have freckles, and then really wild things, because I copied a little list. I just copied a screenshot of my account. So they say 50-50 ability to match musical pitch, which I can. More than likely to have bunions, don't have them yet. More than likely to be afraid of heights, they're right. Less likely than average to have flat feet, that's also right. I have a wicked arch. Less likely to have thick hair is wrong. I have very thick hair. Anyway, these kind of things, right? Are any of them...
I'm laughing about the more likely than average... What is it? Less likely to have a fear of public speaking. That came in handy here.
Yeah, that did. Although, public singing. Oh boy, do I shake. Yeah, so some of it's right. Some of it's not right. I thought 50-50 motion sickness was interesting because I get really car sick in cars, but I'm fine in planes, trains, boats... No problem. But cars, I got to be careful.
So it's planes, trains, and not automobiles.
Not automobiles, no. And then there was this whole thing like, there's a 61% chance you do not have dimples. Correct. There's a 92% chance you do not have a cleft chin. Correct. 74% chance you have detached earlobes. This is when I learned that people have attached and detached earlobes. Mine are detached. Also, they say I've probably never had dandruff, and I really don't, unless I get really dry scalp in the winter. So that's all correct. This is the kind, I'm telling you this for a reason. This is the kind of work that the lab works on, right? So just based on the DNA that they had, they could tell investigators that they were looking for a Korean man who probably had fair skin with no freckles, black eyes, brown hair. And they were even able to provide a computer-generated sketch of what he might look like based on what his DNA says. That I would love to see. I would be so curious to be like, do one of me. I want to see how similar it is. Because I'm just curious, you know?
I mean, it's still kind of a very elaborate guessing game. I mean, it's just statistics and percentages,
this right? is exactly so. It. But what wasn't statistics and percentages was they were able to say, without a doubt, that they're looking for a Korean man. And that is information that they just had never looked into before. And honestly, I have no idea why. It seems like the links to Korea, I mentioned it before, like, I don't know why with the Korea duty-free bag and the sweater that was made in Korea. I don't know why they did. Can you think of any reason that they didn't look into somebody from Korea?
Well, I think because probably it was, maybe they didn't have a big Korean community, because I think it could be, if we're looking for a Korean man, it could be one of two things. It's a man living in the United States who traveled to Korea to visit family, or it's somebody who came to visit from Korea to the US and as a tourist or to visit family members, but who didn't live here, right?
Mm.
Maybe this area, I don't know, didn't have a big Korean community or no Korean community at all. And they figured it must have been, because it's such an isolated area, mm-hmm. it would be more likely that it was a person who visited Korea and lives there. Because right. who else would know the area well enough to drop a body there?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
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 That's my guess.
That's a good guess. Yeah. That's what I figured. It had to be something like, well, we know everyone around here and there's nobody Asian or
yeah. Yeah.
Just small town stuff.
But at least now they have narrowed it down.
Yes. It's huge knowing that they're looking for a Korean yeah. man. That has narrowed it down tremendously from the somewhere between 20 and 50, not married and likes to drink.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. So they pulled together a list of Korean men in the area with a criminal record, and they investigated them each one at a time. They ruled them all out. Then they remembered another really terrible unsolved murder that had happened before Kelly's. Frances Rash was the librarian at the local elementary school. She was a loving wife and mother to her three kids. On January 2nd, 1979, she returned home unexpectedly that morning. Her husband, Robert, was at work, and their oldest son was also not at home, but two of her kids were. So, as she was returning home that morning, we're not sure why she actually came home. We think probably she just forgot something and was running home to pick it up. She noticed that the family dog was loose, and she saw a neighbor. The neighbor had the dog, and she said, oh, I'll send one of the kids out to grab the dog. You know, don't worry about it, and drove up the driveway and parked. But when she opened the door, she found two of her three children, a 13-year-old boy and a 17-year-old girl, tied up and being held at gunpoint.
Jeez, can you even imagine the nightmare?
Nope. Frances, like any mother would, immediately rushed to protect her children. She fought with the attacker. She was able to give her kids enough time to escape, but she ultimately gave her life to save theirs, which is no doubt a choice she would make again. Her daughter was able to get her feet free and get up and make a run for it. So she ran screaming to the neighbor's house for help. And when help arrived, they found the attacker had fled and Frances had been stabbed in the bedroom of the home. She died of her injuries the next day at the hospital. And the kids had both seen the killer and they were able to give a description. And so they described an Asian man who was 26 to 30 years old at the time, 150 to 160 pounds, with shoulder-length hair, slightly tinted metal frame glasses, wearing an orange down jacket with a zipper, dark pants, and carrying a brown attaché case. They created a sketch of what he looked like.
And I wonder if they compared it. I mean, they must have compared it to what the DNA lab came up with, right?
Yeah, I don't think that there's... I'll share pictures. Frances's murder is still unsolved, and so the detectives wondered if they might be connected, if it could be the same unknown Asian man. They also used the suspect list compiled by the investigators on her case, which happened in Dublin, California. And at that time, Dublin was also unincorporated. Dublin is less than a half an hour away by car from the area where Kelly's body was found, so you can understand that they're close enough together that it could make sense. Again, they chased down every lead that they could think of. Some of them were kind of promising, but they were all a dead end. And that's where we are today. Kelly's sister Amanda and I were just chatting about how, like we just discussed, you know, if the killer is Korean, it's probably a lot less likely that they're going to get a genetic match.
Right, because as I said before, if you know your ancestry, there's just much less a chance that you'd bother to take a test.
Exactly. My hope is that eventually there will be an ancestor who doesn't know the whole story, right?
It's getting more and more people who do these kind of tests, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so you just can't give up hope, you know, that someone will be found. The other possibility, of course, and we know as well as anyone to never give up hope, is that someone will hear our podcast or another show or read an article about this case, and they'll think of someone Korean they knew who lived or visited the area in the 80s. Someone will think about their creepy uncle, maybe give the police a tip. What's surprising to me is if it were two killers, I feel like one of them would have caved by now and said something.
I don't necessarily think so, but also, I mean, maybe one of them died soon after, for example.
Yeah, that's absolutely a possibility as well. And we don't even know that it was
two
people.
Or moved away. Or maybe, yeah, first of all, we don't know. Or maybe both of them were not even from here.
Exactly. They could have been visiting the area.
Yeah. It's just such so many possibilities.
I know. If you have any information about the murder of Kelly Poppleton, even if you don't think what you know is important or means anything, please call the Alameda County Sheriff's Office at 510-667-3636 and let them know. Let them decide what's important and
what's
not.
Let them decide. They're gonna figure out if it's relevant or not.
That's right.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. So
can we talk about Bosco now? Because this was really hard.
Yeah.
Upsetting.
It's such an upsetting. The whole thing is so upsetting. So many families hurt. So let's talk about Mayor Bosco. Allegedly, Mayor Bosco, it all started with a bet in a bar, as so many things in a small town do, just period, right? Two other people ran against the dog and they lost fair and square. And so Bosco became honorary mayor of Sunol in 1981. A couple of interesting things about Bosco's story. He had a pretty sweet life. He was actually originally, quote unquote, owned by one man, but he was sort of known to the entire town. He'd kind of go where he wanted and visit where he wanted. And I think one of the things I read, his human was saying how, like, on the upside, sometimes he got three dinners because people would just constantly feed him. But then the flip side of that is, it was like, I think he might have had five walks yesterday. So, like, the whole town loved Bosco, despite the fact that he impregnated, like, all the bitches in town, all of them. They say that all the dogs in that area of Sunol are in some way related to Mayor Bosco. So, don't forget to spay and neuter your pets, everybody. Again, different time. There's also a really fun story about how he once jumped into someone's car without them realizing it and went on vacation with somebody from town. He was just, do you know what I mean? He would go to the bar. He would hang out at the garage. Like, he just went wherever he wanted and he was welcome everywhere.
I mean, he was the mayor. He had every right to go wherever he wanted.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So his original human moved away a few years after he became mayor. And when he had to move, he left Bosco with another guy in town that loved Bosco. And so Bosco got a second human. And this was a man, I believe, named Tom Stillman. So Bosco and Tom once appeared on the television show. It's a game show called The Third Degree, where game show contestants try to guess what your profession is with a series of questions. And they failed to guess Bosco's profession. Nobody knew he was a mayor. Then in 1984, the Daily Star, a British tabloid, found out about the election, and they published an article describing Sunol as, quote, the wackiest town in the world. So I think most people, if they're going to read an article in a tabloid about the wackiest town in the world, like a small town with a dog mayor, you can probably put two and two together and suss out that this is just a bit of fun, right? Because,
yeah.
You know who wasn't in on the joke? China. In 1990, the People's Daily reported on Mayor Bosco using him as propaganda to prove that democratic elections have serious problems. Like, look at this town. They ended up with a dog. Mayor Bosco had a very long, happy life. And he retired from life, as we say, at the age of 15 in 1994. That's such a good... He had such a good,
that's
long,
really a good
happy
speech,
life.
Yeah.
And he went peacefully when it was his time. Today, there's a statue of him in front of the post office. It's a really nice statue of a good boy. And then there's also, okay, so there's, I need to find out from someone who lives there locally. There was a bar in town called Bosco's Bones and Brew with a life-size replica of Bosco. So when I first saw it, Johanna, I gasped because I was afraid they had stuffed him. I was afraid it was actually Bosco, oh, like stuffed, because that's, it really looks like it could be a real stuffed dog. It's not. They say it's a replica, a life-size replica. So you walk in, and it looks like a stuffed dog on a bar. But then, I don't know if you pull his leg, but he pees beer into your glass. Yes. He's a beer tap. So.
Now we need to find somebody who went to that bar.
Has anyone been to Bosco's Bones and Brew? We need to know more about Mayor Bosco, please.
I'm scared of the bones part, to be honest.
I think the bones are for barbecue. Like, I think they serve, like, wings and beer, probably.
Okay, okay.
That's my first guess.
Because it makes it sound like it's Bosco's bones. But it could also be the bones he chewed on.
I think it's supposed to be, like, a joke on the bones he chewed on. But then...
Okay.
I'm guessing they're talking about wings, because here, a big thing with chicken wings is, do you want bone-in or boneless? And boneless chicken wings are not wings. They're chicken tenders.
Yeah.
I don't care. I have no dog in that fight. I don't eat any. I don't chew food off a bone, but my husband's a big wing fan, so I'm aware of the controversy. Something good. Let's talk about something good.
My something good is definitely that my husband was here. We really had a great time. We got a lot done in the garden. There's always things that I need help, obviously. Like last year, he built me these two huge raised beds, and I needed to get soil to fill it up, and we did that. I planted a lot of things already. We went to see the Falco musical one more time. We went to eat so many times, so many times. I can't even begin to describe how much good food we had. One Sunday we were invited at my mom's place and she went absolutely crazy. And there were like 7 meal lunch on a Sunday, which was amazing. So yeah, there was a lot of eating. A lot of watching horror movies, like we watched all The Conjuring and all the Insidious.
I've seen none of those.
We're really up to date with all the Patrick Wilson movies now, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was my something good. How about you?
Nice, nice. I just had such a nice time in Atlanta catching up with my most bestest, the original oldest, dearest friend from when we were 9. And her family, who are my family. Like, if you've taken baths together, if you've tub pictures together, you know, it's a different level. And so it was just amazing. It was so amazing to see them and spend time with my nibblings, which is my new favorite term for nieces and nephews. And Dad and I'm planning my first trip to Texas. I am going to Texas with my dad for a family event, so... I need some good spooky suggestions for Austin, Texas. Right now, the only thing on my must-do list are the bridge bats.
Yes, that's what we talked about when we talked about the Austin X murders, the servant girl murders. Yeah.
Yeah, my dad's cousin has a wedding thing, so...
I'm sure you get a lot of good suggestions by our Austin listeners.
Hellions. I hope so. I'm depending on you guys for a lot of suggestions. Where to stay. I always look up, like, most haunted hotel. So far, it looks like the Driscoll is where we should stay. Keep me posted, people, on what I should be doing in Austin. Yeah.
And I think
All right.
That's it.
That's it.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, please, please leave us a rating and or review on your podcast app. Go to Spotify if you use that. Leave us a comment under the episodes you enjoyed or didn't enjoy. I mean, you can also leave us some critical thoughts. Please go to our webpage, freshhellpodcast.com. There you find a link to our PO box, to our Patreon. The next get-together will be on 5th of April. Also, if you have an interesting story, if something happened in your family, if you, I don't know, are a paranormal investigator or whatever, contact us for our Tell Us Everything, Tell Me Everything segment. We would love to talk to you. If you want to contact us, please write us to our email, freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. And I think that's it. Please tell your pets we said hi, hug them, kiss them, cuddle them. Give them some treats now and then. Be kind to them. Be kind to your fellow human being at least once, unless they're real assholes. And be kind to yourself. That's the hardest part of it all.
It really is. And just remember, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.